This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. The cover of the current issue of Fortune magazine features a company that maintains cult-like secrecy, an organization whose executives never speak to the press, virtually. So secretive, it doesn't even have its name or logo printed on its company headquarters. We're talking here about Trader Joe's. That's the quirky grocery store where the employees wear Hawaiian shirts and many of its products appear and disappear, seemingly on a whim. The store is known for high-quality food, cheaply priced. And even those who don't have a Trader Joe's in town might have heard of its famous two-buck chuck, a decent bottle of wine for just $2. The store has inspired such loyalty in its customers that one posted a YouTube tribute that's been viewed over 500,000 times.
It's booze, it's nuts, it's pills, it's peas, it's the peanut butter made of sunflower seeds. It's a box of soup, it's a bell from a boat, it's yogurt made from the milk of a goat. A bottle of juice with a crazy name. 10 kinds of soy milk that all taste the same. A $2 wine that tastes like four. All your favorite stuff they don't have anymore.
Fortune's Beth Coit joins us now to tell us about what she found in reporting on Trader Joe's. Good morning.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks. And I guess we can tell from that little clip that there's a certain jokey affection for Trader Joe's from those who shop there. But in fact, as you report, this is a very successful company with sales last year at roughly $8 billion.
That's right. And I think that's one of the secrets behind the company. You know, they have this neighborhood store vibe. Yet they are actually quite large. And, you know, in the story, we note that they're bigger than Bed Bath & Beyond, even.
How can this store afford to sell this high-quality food for such a low cost?
Well, it has a very streamlined distribution center, which takes out a lot of the costs. But they also, they buy directly from producers whenever possible, which takes out a lot of costs. So there are no middlemen involved. So they're not going through distributors. Also, because they're buying in such large volume, they can secure large discounts from producers.
You know, one thing about Trader Joe's, for people who've shopped there a long time, is that it was once, there was a Joe. Tell us what that story is, who started it and who owns it now.
Trader Joe's was founded by Joe Coulombe, who is still alive. He's 80. He had the idea that this growing class of educated consumers that was well-traveled was going to want things that reminded them of being abroad. But Joe hasn't had anything to do with the business in about two decades. He sold to the Albrecht family of Aldi Nord, which is a supermarket empire. They're German. And the company is now held in a family trust.
You try to get Trader Joe's to cooperate on your story, and your story is very positive. But the Trader Joe's declined. NPR called them to get their take on your story, and a spokesman politely declined. What's with all the secrecy?
Part of that really does have to do with the ties to the Albrecht family. They are extremely private, and that really has trickled down, you know, into the Trader Joe's culture. Also, the grocery business is highly competitive, and their privately held company, they don't have to give away any of their secrets. So part of it is that they don't. They don't want to talk about, you know, who's supplying for them. They don't want to talk about their streamlined distribution center. They don't really want their consumer to know Stacy's, which is owned by PepsiCo, Frito-Lay, is making their pita chips. It's just, they would rather you think that, you know, it's Trader Joe's brand.
So about that YouTube song, what do you make of that? I mean, what does that say about the whole Trader Joe's experience?
Yeah, I think they really don't do much advertising, and that's partly because their customers are, you know, their best ambassadors of the brand. They tell their friends to go shop here. They tell them about their favorite products, and people really have an obsession with the store. And I think that's going to be the big challenge for them going forward. You know, they'll hit 350 stores soon. They're going into Omaha, and I think really they're going to have to work to keep that quirky, offbeat vibe as they get bigger.
Beth Coit is a reporter for Fortune magazine, which features on its cover Trader Joe's. Thanks very much.
Thanks.
Russian Emperor Peter the Great built St. Petersburg 3 centuries ago, which makes it relatively recent by Russian standards. He imagined a luxurious playground for the ruling elite and a window to Europe. As NPR's David Green reports, there are some residents who think Russia's current leaders are using the city for the same purpose.
summer in St. Petersburg means these incredible white nights. The sun never sets over the canals and cafes, and this cultural capital explodes with life. There's a festival of boats on the river, fireworks, concerts. Who can blame Russian President Dmitry Medvedev for wanting to show off this place?
It also gives me a lot of pleasure to welcome you here at the St. Petersburg Economic Forum.
This summer, he used St. Petersburg as the backdrop to tell fellow leaders that Russia is modernizing.
Changing for its own sake, as well as for the sake of the rest of the world. Thank you.
This place was just a Swedish backwater until Russia claimed the territory 3 centuries ago, and Peter the Great built a grand Russian capital.
Actually, most European city of Russia.
This is Vladimir Gelman. He's dean of political science and sociology at the European University in St. Petersburg. Over lunch, he described how the Soviet government moved their capital to less glamorous but more functional Moscow. This city was renamed Leningrad. Hundreds of thousands here starved to death during the German siege in World War II. And over time, this city became dirty and crime-ridden. But through it all, Peter's European architecture remained. And today, two natives, Medvedev and Prime Minister Vladimir Putin, are leading a renaissance.
I mean, international events, more federal investments.
Really, the city's a showcase again, Gelman said. But he added a big caveat. When it comes to politics, he said, neither Putin nor Medvedev want Russia to be any more European.
Why there is a need? If they would like to redesign the country, yes, you are right. If they would like to make a showcase, one showcase is enough.
So it sounds almost like St. Petersburg is a little Russian playground. You can come here, you can think that you're enjoying Russia if you're a tourist.
To some extent it's true. And of course for tourists who are coming here for, 3, 4, 5 days, it looks like a European face of Russia. And if they will go just 100 kilometers out of the city, they will see an absolutely different landscape.
But many tourists don't go anywhere else, and that may be by design. The Russian government usually requires visitors from the U.S. or Europe to have an official invitation letter and a visa. Not here, though.
This is the biggest sculpture of the collection.
In the new St. Petersburg, they allow visitors off cruise ships and ferries to explore, if escorted at all times by an official tour guide.
And visiting just the points in the program, so they have no free time, they have no, no choice.
Elena Etzina is a curator at one of the hotspots, the Hermitage Museum. She's proud of the art collection, which rivals the Louvre. There are works from all the giants, Picasso, Da Vinci.
And we have more than 20 paintings by Rembrandt, and Return of the Prodigal Son, you know, is considered to be probably the most well-known piece by Rembrandt.
But this European-style museum is only a taste of imperial Russia.
It's not right to say that I know what Russia is after visiting even St. Petersburg, and especially just the Hermitage Museum, because we have no Russian art here.
What does this city mean for the Russians who live here? I met Irorida Titova heading home on a city bus. She's a 66-year-old widow with a haunting past. As a child, she went with her father back and forth from here to Siberia. They were visiting her mother, who was deported by Stalin because of her German descent. I wondered whether today all the tourists in this European-feeling city bother her, passing through without learning much about the darker times.
Yes, one should live in Russia to really understand it. But people can come visit here, see something, and leave. Life was hard for me, but what is it for them? Why should they know?
And actually, Titova herself was on her way back from the Hermitage. I'm in a lovely mood, she said. I've just seen the Picasso exhibit. There was also 24-year-old street musician Victoria Grigorieva. Welcome to our cultural capital, she declared. Please, admire it. Her friend, Andrei Galkin, though, said he can get frustrated. The 21-year-old worries that this gorgeous city may help visitors forget uglier sides of Russia, the corruption or the human rights abuses. Whenever Medvedev or Putin come for a big visit, he said, it means one thing, a police crackdown to make sure there's no mischief. They do hide the real life here, he said. They show off what they want to show off. David Green, NPR News, St. Petersburg, Russia.
Students heading off to college now have lots of decisions to make about which courses to take, but a course on personal finance isn't even an option at many schools. That's despite the fact that many undergraduates leave school tens of thousands of dollars in debt. Youth Radio's Ariel Edwards-Levy reports that many college students don't even know what they need to know about money.
When Fahia Rashid started college at UC Irvine, she thought she knew most of the financial traps to avoid. Chatting at an LA coffee shop, she says her father's experience taught her to watch her spending.
When he was in college, he went crazy. He had like 18 different credit cards. He took student loans, and now he's almost 50 still paying that money back, and there's not a stop to it. So he told me, you know, just limit yourself to one or two cards and spend very wisely. Do not spend money you don't have.
But during her freshman year, Rashid faced an unexpected problem.
When he starts school, they give you a whole bunch of loans. They're like, okay, take this, take that, take this. And I was under the impression that I needed all of that money. So I said yes to every single one of them, which was a bad idea. And of course...
She returned as many of the unnecessary loans as possible, about $3,000 worth. Rashid figures the less she borrows now, the better off she'll be after years of compounding interest. Problems like hers are common, says financial expert Kathy Kristoff, because students aren't taught about money.
Most of them are pretty clueless when they first start college, unless their parents have been really doing a great job about educating them about finance all along. We just don't get much financial education in high school, and then parents send their kids off to college, kind of like, you know, pushing them out of the nest.
Kristoff, who wrote the book Taming the Tuition Tiger, says the biggest mistake students make is getting into too much debt, especially by taking out private student loans. She says the loans are easy to confuse with federal loans, but they have much higher interest rates. There are other financial lessons that have to be learned through experience. USC student Arlene Washington says living on her own taught her to budget. She learned to save money for hidden fees on things like student government, as well as for smaller purchases.
When you're living with your parents, you don't know everything that comes into what you need to support yourself. So then once you go on your own, there might be certain things, even as little as toilet tissue.
She says her best lessons in finance came from her job on campus.
Because, you know, you would get your check at a certain time of the month, and then if you get that check, you say to yourself, well, how much can I spend or how much do I need to use on certain things monthly? Mm-hmm. Whether it be bills or, you know, different things. I need to buy food, things like that.
Financial expert Kristoff says making sure kids have jobs is one way parents can teach them about money, but it has to be part of a larger conversation.
If you've been all along, all through high school, talking to your kids about money, it's good to let them fly solo right now and take the responsibility for their finances. If you know you haven't done that, then you want to wean them from your protection over time.
Kristoff sees no fast way to make college-bound students financial pros. But she says learning how to manage money is as important as what you learn in the classroom. For NPR News, I'm Ariel Edwards-Levy.
And that story was produced by Youth Radio.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. The Peace Corps celebrates its 50th anniversary next year. When it was created, joining the Peace Corps usually meant leaving family, friends, and way of life behind. Well, now with cell phones and internet access, volunteers are a lot more connected. Reporter Zach Badorf tells us from Rwanda about how technology is changing the Peace Corps.
Back in the early 80s, Gordy Mengel served as a Peace Corps volunteer in an isolated community in what was then called Zaire, now Congo.
I was placed someplace in the middle part of the country. And there were no, in the small community where I lived, there was no post office. So getting letters out, which was basically the only means of communication, was very challenging.
Letters would take weeks, sometimes months, to arrive. Now a Peace Corps training officer in Rwanda, Mengel says increased communication has changed the Peace Corps experience. He said when he served, he lost track of friends and relationships back home. He had no choice but to integrate into the community.
These days, with the advent of the internet and cell phone service and so forth, I still see volunteers having some of that experience, but again, when they go back to their homes, instead of turning out the kerosene light and going to bed, they can get on Skype or they can give a quick call to mom and dad back at home. And that, you know, that part of the experience, I guess, has changed.
Hey,
Sonia Morange talks with a friend in San Francisco over Skype. She's one of about 100 Peace Corps volunteers now serving in Rwanda. The San Diego native works at an organization in Kigali called Never Again Rwanda, organizing plays about the country's 1994 genocide that left 800,000 dead. She talks over the phone with her mom and emails her dad. She hasn't mailed a single letter through the postal system and can't imagine waiting months for one to arrive.
I know, I cannot believe it. I can't imagine having been a Peace Corps volunteer in the 70s or the 80s or even the early 90s. I'm just so used to everyone having a cell phone that works internationally. I'm very, very lucky in the fact that where I live, I have wireless internet, and that makes it a lot easier.
This week, Sonia's parents visited her in Rwanda. Her mother, Beverly, said she was proud to have her daughter join the Peace Corps.
And then at the same time, because she's going to be going far away and concerns about health and safety and the kinds of things a mother thinks about.
But Beverly has been able to keep tabs on her daughter.
Oh, yes. We talk every weekend, pretty much. And I'm also there if she needs me, you know, at any time she can call me.
For 24-year-old Sonia, it's nice to know that her friends and family are always just a phone call or a few clicks away.
Peace Corps is full of ups and downs, and, I mean, you're thrown into an environment that you're not familiar with, you're out of your element. No matter what, you're going to have breakdowns and moments of just moments where you just need help and you need support.
Peace Corps Rwanda Country Director John Reddy agrees. He served as a volunteer back in 1967 in the tiny landlocked African nation of Lesotho. He says the added connectivity has provided volunteers with a support system that wasn't available in the early days of the Peace Corps. For the volunteers, he says it's helpful.
It's not always helpful to Peace Corps staff when if a volunteer is telling their family they're having a bad day or a bad week, and then the family member calls Peace Corps Washington, and Peace Corps Washington calls me, and I have to find the volunteer and see what the problem was. That didn't happen so much in the old days.
Reddy has spent nearly a quarter of a century working for the Peace Corps in Africa. He said before the internet, Peace Corps staff had more independence.
Personally, I feel there's a lot more micromanagement from Washington than there used to be. I sort of long for the days before the internet and good phone service.
For NPR, I'm Zach Badorf.
From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. This week we're hearing about primary care under pressure. Primary care is the basic medical care people need. Today, NPR's Julie Robner visits a nonprofit medical clinic in Maine. It's among those around the country pioneering a concept called a medical home. The idea is to make health care more effective and more efficient for both doctors and patients, and it may help attract more doctors to primary care practice.
As recently as a couple of years ago, Doug Cooper was like a lot of primary care doctors, overworked and unhappy.
I was here for 12-hour days and felt like times like I had no personal life and no flexibility, and I was in this office or in the two exam rooms and just spent the time ping-ponging back and forth.
It got so bad at one point he even considered leaving medicine, but he realized he couldn't.
That's not where I want to go. I really like taking care of patients. I like the interaction, that personal one-on-one encounter.
Things are different now. His work life is much more sane. There's even a bicycle wedged up between the desk and the wall in his tiny cubicle of an office.
That's one big thing, is that I can get here and back home during daylight hours on a bicycle.
Doug Cooper was one of several people who developed a whole new way of practicing primary care medicine at Martin's Point. He now works more as part of a team he leads. It helps doctors offload some of their daily work to nurses and other practitioners, but also helps improve the quality of care patients get. In a lot of ways, it's sort of a recreation of the old-time general practitioner's office, where every person in the office knew every patient.
Hi, Mark. It's Patty with Dr. Cooper's office. How can I help you?
Patty O'Regan is a registered nurse and a key member of the team.
Oh, okay.
She used to sit down the hall and around the corner.
Right.
Now she sits at a desk right outside Cooper's office so they can ask and answer each other's questions more easily. O'Regan actually quit Martin's Point a couple of years ago. She says she couldn't handle the pace and the lack of organization.
There was no question it had to change. You couldn't keep doing it the way we were doing it.
One way the new approach, this medical home, helps streamline things is by letting each member of the team do what they're most qualified to under law. It's called practicing to the top of their license. What it really means is having doctors like Doug Cooper give up some control.
You know, some of this is really learning to work together and trust your team.
For example, Cooper now has Nurse O'Regan do most prescription refills. He says it's been a major time saver.
I would get 20, 30, I'm not sure you could count how many refill requests in a given day.
The team has also worked on saving time for patients, literally. Cooper wanted to know how long it took from the time they walked in the door until the time they were ready to walk out.
Patient is given a clipboard with a stopwatch and a pen, and they're told, keep track. And they're all over it. They love it. They're like, okay.
But working as a team is about a lot more than efficiency. A medical home is also supposed to be about improving the quality of health care. That brings Cooper to the non-human member of his team, Martin's Point's electronic medical record. It's there in the exam room when he's seeing a patient.
And so how's the heart been doing?
Well.
No chest pains.
No chest pains.
And back in his office, Cooper can really demonstrate what he can do with all that data he and others have just typed in.
Patient names. I can put a filter on here and select only Dr. Cooper patients, so I can
with a couple of clicks, he calls up a database of all his patients with high blood pressure.
And then I can start manipulating this data. I can get in and I can say, okay, everybody here has an elevated blood pressure. Let's go look at their previous blood pressure.
Now he's looking at how long it's been since they've last been in the office.
I can say, okay, here's a couple patients who haven't been in a couple of years.
And he'll have Patty or his medical assistant, Tricia, call to schedule an appointment. But even that's not what gives the number-loving Cooper his biggest thrill. What he really wants to show off is what's just outside his office.
The wall of knowledge.
The wall of knowledge. It's where Cooper really geeks out, tracking the health of his entire patient population on a pair of bulletin boards. There's a mind-boggling series of charts and graphs. He can tell you, for example, that 98% of his hypertension patients now have their blood pressure under control. But unless Cooper's patients happen to stop and look, all this is basically invisible. Which explains why, if you ask long-time patients, like Goldie McKenney, if they perceive any change, they say no.
It's just very efficient. Everything goes like clockwork for us. Yeah, we're just content with all the care we get.
And Cooper says that's just as it should be. For most patients, nothing appears to have changed. But for some patients, the medical home has meant access to services they didn't have before. For example, Martin's Point also has health educators, people like nurse practitioner Alicia Greenwald. She specializes in diabetes education.
My nickname is the Diabetes Queen. I have a crown to prove it.
Greenwald's job is to see patients who need more time to work through medication or even social issues connected with their disease.
I didn't tell anybody, but I was getting...
Today she's seeing a sprightly 88-year-old named Mary Coyne, who's suffering from a common diabetic complication called neuropathy.
Bed bugs, but something.
And that's exactly what a lot of people describe neuropathy to feel like to them.
Afterwards, Greenwald says many patients just need someone to explain what's going on.
She didn't really know what the word was. She didn't really understand that feeling like bugs were biting her was a symptom of neuropathy, and she needed clarification on that so that she knew that she didn't have bed bugs, which is what she was worried about.
But while doctors and patients may be happier and healthier in Martin's Point's medical home, what will really determine the success or failure of the medical home is whether or not it actually saves money. That's a big concern for Lisa Letourneau. She's heading up a separate program to build more medical homes in Maine. She says many of the ongoing experiments aren't focused enough on costs.
And I'm afraid that's going to bite us in the end. You know, unless we can demonstrate this not only improves quality and patient experience and controls costs, we're going to be stuck.
But in order to really make that all happen, quality, efficiency, and cost, there's going to have to be serious attitude adjustments on the part of both doctors and their patients. Martin's Point CEO David Howes says more doctors will have to get over the idea that they're the only ones qualified to deliver medical care.
And if we can't help physicians to move from a place where they are the center of every decision that is made to a place where they can delegate and share decisions with trusted teammates, then this won't work.
Meanwhile, says Letourneau, patients will have to do some compromising, too.
We are used to, in America, more is better. We apply that to healthcare. We assume that more healthcare is better, and it is not. And in fact, it is often dangerous to us.
Expect to see more medical homes popping up around the country. The new health law includes funding to help more primary care providers transform their practices into care teams like those at Martin's Point. Julie Rovner, NPR News.
And tomorrow, Julie wraps up her series with a visit to a physician assistant. Along with nurse practitioners, physician assistants are helping to alleviate the shortage of primary care doctors in the country.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer. With unemployment at close to 10%, work is hard enough to find. For some people, the biggest barrier to moving on to a new job is moving out of their existing home. People can't leave because they can't find a buyer or because their mortgage is underwater, meaning they owe more than their home is now worth. Historically, job opportunities have been the leading reason that people relocate. In the first of a two-part series, NPR's Yuki Noguchi looks at how the lack of mobility complicates things for people looking for jobs.
Melissa Brooks and her husband had a plan. They wanted to move from Lansing, Michigan to Atlanta to be closer to family and to improve their job prospects. But now their home is standing between them and their plans.
So everything's kind of just centered on selling this house here in Michigan, and it's been over a year now and it has not happened, not even an offer.
Brooks has kept her career on hold so she can be ready for a move. She's also kept the house on the market, which is now a short sale, meaning it's listed for less than what they still owe on it.
Recently, I guess I've been angry at the people looking to buy my home, which sounds crazy because I want to sell the home. But I guess that's what I'm angry about. Now that it's priced this low, people are looking and they're starting to ask questions like, well, what about this? Are you going to repaint the deck? And I feel like, you know, don't ask me anything because I'm short selling this house and we're not doing anything else to it.
She says this past year has left scars. Home ownership once seemed prudent. Now Brooks feels frustrated and bitter.
I didn't expect, I guess, it to be an emotional experience to try and sell and move out of a house, but I feel like I've been burned and I feel like, you know, I don't want to open myself up to buy another house.
Renting now seems like the far more responsible choice, so they aren't locked out of taking jobs in the future. This is the fallout from the crash in the housing market. Americans who expected mobility now find themselves grounded. They can't move to better job markets without taking a huge financial hit. Real estate professor Joe Jorko at Wharton says, taken as a whole, this phenomenon is devastating to the labor market.
Outside of outright foreclosure itself and the loss of wealth, it's probably the most important impact of over-leveraging the housing market that we're going to have in this cycle.
Jorko says some markets could take many years to recover. Some people may opt to wait it out, hoping that home prices will eventually rebound, but others may simply choose to walk away.
If you need a job and you need to improve your life chances, you know, why not? I mean, it's not that it's free, it's not that it doesn't cost you, but it may be worth paying that price.
Tony Abram has considered that. The large telecom company he works for has been downsizing, so he has been looking for work elsewhere, including out of state. But he can't afford to drive far from his home in Douglasville, Georgia, and Abram says it's declined so much in price he can't afford to sell it either.
We were really ready to leave. When we were painting the walls and everything and getting everything done. And that assessment just took the wind out of everything we were doing.
Abram wanted to join the Air Force, but moving for that is also out of the question. So it appears he'll be stuck for some time.
My father's buying a house four houses down from me, same floor plan that I have for half the price that I paid for mine. And when I saw that, it gives me that feeling of, oh my God, I'm never going to get out of this neighborhood.
Abram hopes things won't get worse. He's willing to put his career on hold for another two or three more years and hope for the best. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News.
Visit NPR.org to see a map that has state-by-state information on underwater mortgages. And if you're trying to sell a house, we'd like to hear how that's going.